Thanks. And Jane Sunderland is also joining us. And so we're here to talk a little bit about this whole idea of monetizing. And I think you'll see points and counterpoints and some consistency across us too. So I think to start, Jane was going to lead us off with some slides and take us through some things. And then I'm going to do a little bit of slides, and then we're going to open it up for kind of, we can do commentary this way or we can do commentary this way, right? So start thinking of some questions, and we'll do some Q&A. All right. You want to come up here or you want to go there?
Yeah.
All right. And I see a clicker, so you're good.
Presentation queued up. I'm so sorry. It sent over, right? Hold on just one second. Hang on.
Well, while we're getting started, so when I was asked to join this panel, first thing was, I have to tell you that I was reluctant because the whole topic of monetizing piracy was something that I generally wasn't in favor of, but it was a topic that I did say I had some interesting thoughts that I wanted to add. So as you can see, my topic is really about thoughts and caveats, but coming back around to it, also have some interesting ideas that come back to what Brett is actually talking about just before this, which is about very important that there are some interesting initiatives that are out there that get to the idea of data-driven decisions that come from piracy data that lead you to some great, you know, positive initiatives that I think would be good to do. So how do I click forward on this? Sorry.
Give a permit.
There you go. Starting point out. Anything that I discuss today are really my opinions, and although I'm a consultant with Lionsgate, these are not the opinions of Lionsgate. Okay. So the topics I'm going to cover are sort of a historical view about monetizing peer-to-peer, give you a little perspective on that, and then a little bit of some policy perspective on where this sits right now on a very important study that's going on in the Copyright Office about the Copyright Office Section 512 study. I don't know if anybody's aware of this, but this is all about the notice and takedown regime in the U.S. and the ISP safe harbors. Then also taking us into streaming and social media, where there's some interesting developments that are going on that people really should be looking to. Also about the value gap in the streaming social media area. And finally, again, looking at the data-driven decisions, a little bit about what Brett was talking about. So monetizing on peer-to-peer. Bottom line, anti-piracy strategies are not one-size-fits-all. You can't take a strategy that might work in one area for one type of property and just exploit it anywhere in the world for any kind of title. So, and I think this idea of doing peer-to-peer monetization. And let me define what I mean by that. That's where you send demand notices to end users on peer-to-peer for settlements. So the idea is that you identify who the users are on peer-to-peer, and you believe you've identified who the infringers are, and you use the notice sending system to send notices to those end users to say, I've found you, I've identified who you are, and I believe that you are guilty of this and you should now pay me. Essentially, maybe it's a license fee, maybe it's, you know, what, instead of taking you to court, I now think you owe me money. And so you send these demand notices. So that may work in certain territories for a certain kind of property, certain kind of titles, but it doesn't necessarily work appropriately in all territories. So as a matter of fact, one of the places where this first started was in Germany. And it actually works really, really well in Germany because the culture there, the laws, the courts are completely set up for this process. And it is well suited to Germany. And Germany has among the lowest levels of peer-to-peer piracy, as a matter of fact. I don't know if it's because of this structure, the culture and the laws and the specific courts, but there's no resistance to this process whatsoever. And we have very low peer-to-peer piracy in Germany. But in the U.S., as you probably are aware, the ISPs in the U.S. strongly resist this whole idea of demands for settlements being sent to their consumers. There's also the consumer organizations, there's a large backlash. A number of judges also have taken, you know, close scrutiny to anything that ends up in their courts about this as well, and look very closely at the kind of evidence that's presented and have rejected some of these cases as well. There's been some evidence right now that the vendor business models don't appear to be prospering at this point in time. So I'm not sure that the U.S. is the kind of place where this business model is necessarily appropriate. And I'm going to give you a little more background about right now why this may not be the best place for it. And that's because of the Copyright Office Section 512 study. Why does this matter? It's all about notice and takedown. This is about the safe harbors, the liability of internet services for online infringements. I don't know, who's aware of this study right now? Is anybody aware of this, what's been going on? See, I'm glad I'm here to tell you a little bit about this. This is very, very significant right now. It's essentially copyright wars that are going on at the moment. Earlier this year, actually it started last December, Copyright Office, at the request of Congress, issued a request for comments about is Section 512 of the copyright law working, which gives the safe harbors to ISPs and for notice and takedown. Is this entire process working? And there were 92,000 comments submitted to the Copyright Office. They've never had this many comments submitted on any topic ever before. And the second round of comments are now due in February 2017. So what are the safe harbor provisions, limitations on liability? What that means is, under this section of the copyright law, basically ISPs are not liable for copyright infringement if they do certain things. And this section of the law defines different categories of ISPs. The 512A are those ISPs that are basically transitory digital network communications. That means, you know, the ISPs that have peer-to-peer users, they are not hosting the content, but they're the ones that have peer-to-peer users. So they have certain obligations. And the 512C, those are the ones you're usually thinking about. Those are the ones that host content. Those are the ones that have the actual obligations that are defined in the law for the notice and takedown. All ISPs actually have obligations to terminate repeat infringers, strangely enough, but the only ones that have obligations that are defined in the law to respond to takedown notices are the 512C, the ones that host content. So it's important to know that that's what's written in the law, that those ISPs that only have transitory content, which is what peer-to-peer content is, there's nothing in the law that says that they are supposed to respond to takedown notices. Hence, in these reply comments, all the ISPs were vehemently responding. They have no obligation to respond to notices that have to do with peer-to-peer content. And the only things that, you know, what you've seen in the past is voluntary agreements that they have put in place. They've gone beyond what the law has required them to do. And you may be aware of the voluntary agreement that the six biggest ISPs have put in place to work with certain rights holder groups to accept notices and forward them to their rights holder, or to their customers. But outside of that, they are adamant that there's no obligation under the law to actually forward those notices. And beyond that, they're extremely adamant that the notices that actually, any notices that have to do with demands for settlement are an actual abuse of the law. So, and what you need to know in addition in these comments, there were a lot of discussions about what kinds of abuse of the DMCA, Digital Millennium Copyright Act, have been in place. And one of the specific abuses of the law have been these demands for settlement. And there are recommendations that are out there. They're saying that we should put in place penalties, financial penalties, for anybody who's doing this, for the rights holders and for the vendors who are doing this. There are a lot of other abuses of the DMCA, like if you make a mistake, they want you to pay a penalty as well, because they say it takes up so much of their time and effort to deal with these. So with that background on peer-to-peer, streaming and social media, right now in the U.S., streaming is predominant form of piracy. So one of the things that, you know, everybody's aware that there's a lot of monetization on the social media like YouTube, and that's advertising. So has anybody here heard of the value gap? So the value gap is something that the music industry has identified, which is really critical. And that has to do with the fact that their subscription-based revenues are vastly out more than what they're getting from the ad-supported. And yet there's a hugely more users on the ad-supported. So, and what's really going on here, and you'll see also the value gap is getting higher, that you have more and more streaming users but getting less and less money out of it. And the bottom line they're saying is that what's happening is that the notice and takedown system, intended as a reasonable enforcement mechanism, has instead been subverted into a discount licensing system where copyright owners and artists are paid for less than their creativity is worth. And the reason this is working, they say, is because YouTube, for example, allows a lot of pirate content on its site, doesn't remove that content, monetizes that content, and therefore uses that as a way to reduce the license value that they'll pay for music. In the comments that were submitted in this 512 study, Warner Music Group, for example, documented exactly what happened to them when they tried to negotiate with YouTube on this, and that they actually tried to remove their licensed content. They spent $2 million in notice and takedown efforts and trying to use Content ID to remove their content while they negotiated better rates. And they couldn't end up negotiating better rates with YouTube over this. So that takes us to Facebook. This was mentioned earlier today as well, the growth of video on Facebook. Facebook has decided that it wants to be the predominant video platform. Facebook Live launched last year. The video limit expands to 2 hours earlier this year. The levels of piracy have expanded wildly on Facebook Live. There's been some advertising on Facebook, and they're about to monetize. You know, they're launching their monetization of the, you know, user-uploaded content sometime soon. All I would advise is I think people need to be studying this area as well and take a close look at this. So with that as a background, I would say, though, despite these caveats, there's some, you know, interesting data-driven decisions and opportunities out there. Very important to continue to collect and evaluate piracy data. The music industry, IFPI, has been doing a terrific job of this. I think everybody should be doing this. You should seek out new sources of data, like social media marketing companies have a lot of information about their users and what you can use about this. In addition, I say work very closely with the business units about what information is important to them and what business directions are good for them. Target outreach for users who both pirate and legitimately consume, because we know there's a lot of studies that show that there's a lot of crossover between those users. And as I try to click it forward, finally, work creatively with legitimate partners to address piracy, because even those ISPs who are adamant that you can't send notices to them for peer-to-peer users, bottom line, like Verizon was the biggest one who said they didn't want to receive notices. We know all of those now have video platforms and music platforms as well. They're in the business with us as well. So I think they're willing to work creatively on some interesting solutions now as well.
All right, let's see. Okay. So we're thinking of those questions. I'm going to be coming back to you. All right. Okay, so growing the business through conversion from piracy. So I'm going to talk from an Adobe perspective. It's a little different than my days at Disney and the film and television business, but it's probably not that much different because we're all in here together and we are all consumers, and my Adobe customers are your customers. And so ultimately, there's a lot of crossover. Let me just say, one of the big questions I always get is, how do I move from the cost side where we're spending money to ultimately reduce actual loss or perceived loss, which isn't an area that gets me that excited. I'm much more focused on how do we spend money to make money, right? So how do we take the things that we do and allow it to actually boost the business, right? And my history and experience has been that it's hard to get dollars if you're on the cost side. It's easy to get dollars if you're on the other side. They give you money to make money. And this is just saying this isn't a new topic. I think you're hearing it consistently here in that there's been multiple studies going on for years that have shown, for example, these are articles that I had written and published in a number of things. And again, I think it's all still relevant that the primary message was the biggest pirates are your biggest customers. That was what we found in the movie and television space. Fans are fans, right? And you want to take advantage of the fact that they actually want the content. Come on. Somewhere, there we go. Okay, so to me, one of the key things that we need to focus on is, what's the user motivation? Who are we talking about as a actual user, as a consumer? All right, so if I looked at consumers that have non-genuine software, so I'm not going to talk about them as pirates, I'm just going to say people that have non-genuine Adobe software fall into three groups. So the first one is what we call pirate inclined. That's your pirate user, right? But we define it a little bit farther. We say limited motivation or capacity to buy genuine, right? So these are people that aren't necessarily going to be actually a traditional customer from us. Then there, you can go to the next one. You can just click them up. And there's opportunistic. These are people who are price sensitive. They're going to look for a deal. They're typically going to look for a deal online. And then there's legally inclined people that are, they just want genuine, and they happen to take the path and wind up getting victimized. And you can click it one more time. There we go. And so my focus is customers that did pay or will pay, right? Not necessarily the pure pirates on the right side that aren't necessarily our customers. If I take those demographics and I look at it by market, and I know this is an eye chart, so I'm sorry, but on the left side are all the mature markets that you'd imagine, right? US, Japan, the UK, stuff like that. And what you see is roughly 75 to 80% of the people are inclined to pay, right? And this was a really important message for us, and it's what really we built the basis of a core business strategy on, is that the majority of the people are not trying to steal from us, right? And so our focus is kind of in that lower left quadrant, right? People that are inclined to pay and people in typically mature markets. China, by the way, is the next to the far right, right? So we have a huge install base in China. Lots of people with Adobe software in China. Not a lot of motivation to pay us, right? So it's really easy to get install base. It's really hard to make a business of it, right? And so it really says, okay, we can make a business of it. And so we went through a major shift in orientation from company as victim, right? This, I've heard this for years and years and years. We need more law. We need more enforcement. We need all this stuff. And what we really found was the majority of our customers that we know are on non-genuine software are much more victim than they are pirate, right? Now, it might be unique to us, and it may not translate completely, but a portion of it translates, right? Because they're the same customers. And so we as Adobe shifted completely to a completely different point of view, and It's reflected in strategies. Don't worry about all the white stuff. Just say that the five major strategies are in orange, right? How do we have a shift in principles? That's what I just talked about. How do we capture more of the demand? That's a business strategy that says, if the demand is going on and our marketing is working and people want our software, how do we orient the business to actually capture that demand? Third one is, how do we protect our customers from being victimized? Fourth one is, convert them. Fifth one is, do the lobby and all the other stuff. And so this is just an example on the left side. Imagine this was a build chart, but on the left side is a Google search result, and if it didn't have the colored boxes on it, it's just a search result for Adobe Acrobat 11 full version. So it doesn't say crack, download, free, hack, any of that stuff in it, right? Everything in red was a counterfeit seller. Right? So this was before we started any cleanup of the space, but it shows that true counterfeit sellers had really penetrated one of our mainstream go-to-market channels, right? And that as you as a customer, it didn't matter how well-intentioned you were, the chances are you were going to get counterfeit product, right? And so we had to really work to clean that up. I'm happy to say this isn't a whack-a-mole game. Again, I've said that before to this audience. You want help on how to clean up the online space, we can do it. But that's so today, in 12 major markets of the world, I'm happy to report that we're basically clean top two pages of search engines, marketplaces, stuff like that. So anyway, that kind of gives you a sense, at least, that I always hold hope that there is actually money to be made. Piracy isn't a pure lose-lose proposition. There's some aspects of turning it around. But it's not a single thing, right? It does count on some enforcement that's out there and laws and, other sticks, as Brett talked about. But the carrots, to me, are less about incentivizing and, in many ways, changing the business process to get in front of the customer that wants your product anyway, right? How do I close that gap between their demand, their desire, and my business model, right? All right, comments here? Comments out there? Nothing? Come on, this is like, we're not right after
we're
lunch.
We're Taco Coma, ladies and gentlemen.
I know, that's what I'm thinking.
Taco Coma.
Those tacos were good.
Yes, hello, I'm Niels with Very Matrix. I love the numbers and the data, thank you, really interesting. I'd like to understand a little bit on the methods on how to get it for Brett. How do you measure the sales or the piracy, or for Richard, how do you categorize in the different groups?
You want to go first?
Sure. are you asking more where the data come from, or then what do we do with the data to actually give an answer you can trust?
Where does it come from? How do you know the sales after certain, before and after certain?
Yeah, so it depends on the study in question, of course. But there are a couple different channels. Sometimes it's publicly available data, like box office revenues. Sometimes it can come from third-party vendors, like you can get things from Nielsen, right? And then in some cases, when that's not possible, when there's no trusted third-party source, sometimes we have to go straight to the firms, and that's part of the value of having an academic research center, is that the firms know that if they turn over their data, we're under NDA, we can only write this one paper with it, and they also can share data without worry that the other studios or labels are going to see it. So I guess I would say publicly available, or a third-party vendor when those are trustworthy, or sometimes we just have to go straight to the firms and take advantage of our status as a safe academic research center.
Yep, and from our side, if you're just really talking about the demographic splits, that was done as a research study in partnership with Microsoft. So Microsoft actually fielded the study. I funded into it and worked with them because it was of interest to both of us. We both had basically the same issue. Our market overlaps are similar. The consumer demographics are similar. So it made a lot of sense for us to partner up and field a study across all these different countries and basically look for the demographic split and figure that out. Right? Because it's the same kind of demographic split that doesn't play just to piracy. It was really saying, well, how did people acquire things? I mean, sitting underneath that are a lot of questions, because people don't just go, oh, I have pirated goods, right? I mean, you have to start asking questions like, oh, where do you buy? What did you get? What did you, right? All those things, yeah.
I have a question. When did you do that study, and do you and Microsoft plan to update that study?
We did that study 2 years ago, late 2014 into 2015. We are thinking about it, but it's really a question of, do we think it's evolved much? And actually, we don't think it has evolved much. We think those demographics are pretty stable. Stable enough that we don't have to redo it because it's, you know, it's not kind of at a granular level. It's really saying, you know, the primary message for us and the rest of the business heads was, you know, for example, in Brazil, if the market's 50% people that actually want to pay, right? And again, for years they've said, oh, no one in Brazil wants to pay, right? As soon as we did the study and came back, we could say, well, it might not be 50-50, it might be 60-40, but it got us focused on those that want to pay instead of those that don't, right? Because for 20 years, the focus has always been stop piracy, do all these things, and all of a sudden we've got a booming Brazil business because we focused on the right side, you know, what I would say the dollar sign side.
Right. I got a question here.
So following up on that, Kip from Movie Labs, what business model changes did you make to close the gap between those folks that wanted to pay but weren't and what you were doing before?
So a number of things. One of the things was, for example, in Brazil, we were a company that largely said, well, Brazil's going to be whatever it is because they're all pirates down there. Right? So you don't do pricing studies, you don't really field varieties, you don't try to get out and understand the demographic. We just stood back and said, you know, we're not, whatever money we make, right? It was really then saying, no, let's focus on Brazil because it actually could be quite a big market, right? So we started doing field studies, we started changing our go-to-market strategy, we actually started doing marketing in the market focused on how do you get it. Where, you know, who are our legitimate partners? How do you get it that way? At the same time, we cleaned up the online space. We cleaned up a lot of routes to market. And so you all of a sudden had customers thinking differently and us as a business being present, right? So a big part of the business change was largely they weren't present in the market, right? So it's almost the same thing you're hearing. It's a slightly different thing, but it's saying, if I don't make my product available and people want it, they will find a way to get it, right? But as soon as I start to close that gap and make it available through legitimate channels, push the dark stuff to the edge, right, to the shadows, it's not gone, it's just not mainstream. The mainstream people begin to migrate to your business models and, you know, doesn't change overnight, right? I mean, it's part of what we heard, you know? I'll take a 28% change in my business, right? Because depending on what that means, that could have just doubled the business, right? I mean, again, you know, guys are scratching over 3% changes, and, you know, if I can do 28%, that's huge, huge, right?
Another question over here.
Just wonder, you know, as far as the subscription and things like, you know, reducing the partnership with, you know, specifically to Adobe. I know Microsoft done similar thing, but how much that had to do with reduction of piracy?
Not much at all. So there's two things going on. We kind of call it Creative Cloud or, you know, our cloud products. But essentially, it's moving to a subscription-based model, payment model. Some people love it. Other people hate it. It kind of is what it is, right? And so that's created some people that have said, oh, I've always been a loyal customer, but I'm not going. I'm going to go to the pirate side. But that's not the majority of people. I mean, it does cause us a little friction, but not huge. And our products are still mainly, even though we have cloud aspects, they're still mainly run at the desktop level. So largely that's not, it hasn't solved piracy, right? People say, oh, it's all cloud-based, piracy's gone away. We're not cloud-based, piracy hasn't gone away. It's pretty much the same. So it hasn't changed much of the dynamics at all.
Brett?
Yeah, I was really intrigued by what you said about kind of cleaning up, I guess, search results was kind of what, right?
Search results, marketplaces, and some social.
Right. So, you know, it's funny. When you're talking about that, you're seeing sort of a business opportunity or a success story. When I'm seeing that, I'm seeing, so over time, you were creating different jumps or variants in the level of, in the sort of the search, what the search, it didn't all happen overnight. Right? So to me, that's a really interesting kind of experiment that happened out there over time because of something you were doing. And I'm thinking, I've got an X variable, a slowly changing amount of piracy search links due to your intentional sort of almost exogenous actions, right? And then I can start looking at some Y variable like change in sales and piracy ratios right. over time and see how that maps out. Yeah. So, you know, I find that really interesting, and that's the thing that really works between academia, our research is we don't know what's going on out there all the time. And sometimes you guys know what's going on out there, but you don't realize that there's a methodology that takes advantage of that as a natural experiment. Exactly. And when those two things come together, that's when we get really cool work.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple things I'll kind of second that is that there's two things I think both from our CDSA board discussions of yesterday and hearing it here is I think we could share more case studies. There's a lot of great work going on in a number of places, and we could do more case studies and less kind of philosophical jabber about what's going on, because I think we can copy and replicate things sometimes much easier than kind of figuring it out on our own. Second thing is, yes, we can use academia to validate our assumptions in many cases and, you know, kind of put the stamp of, you know, if you can prove causality, great, but if it's correlation enough, but you've got enough data points, then you're kind of home free too, right? For me, the big correlation is dollar up, yeah. right? Action, result. Right? I know we're over time. Any last questions?
I think we are over time. I'm so sorry. But hey, by the way, you know, find each other.
We'll
find each other on the last break before the breakouts. Hey, thank you so much, Brett, Jane. Thank you. Richard, fantastic session.